Dieselgate, and he's not been a free man since. And his health, his physical health and his mental health are obviously deteriorating, because he's only a man. He's a fighter. He's a strong person, a strong-willed person who believes in the work that he's done, and he's aware that this is a fight that against a monumental injustice. But there's only so much a man can take.
Stella, since we've spoken, you had applied to be married, the two of you. The prison forbade that and then reversed their decision. And today, as you stood outside the new court ruling, you said, "Today we won, but Julian continues to suffer. Julian must be freed." Your final 10-second comment.
Well, you know, Julian, for every win that we get, Julian's situation doesn't seem to change. And this is punishment through process. And it has to end. The Biden administration should just drop this. We shouldn't have to be taking it through the UK justice system, because this is a political prosecution that was initiated by the Trump administration. And it is causing ongoing harm, not just to Julian,
we
not
have
to just
leave it
to
there.
Us.
Stella Morris, thank you so much for being with us. I'm Amy Goodman.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Oregon Health Authority holds two hearings on masking and COVID-19 vaccination requirements. A new report says Oregon has just one-third of its public defenders its legal system needs, and the State Department recommends American diplomats leave Ukraine as threats of a Russian invasion loom. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 24th, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. On Monday, the Oregon Health Authority held two public hearings on masking and COVID-19 vaccination requirements. The first hearing focused on masking rules in schools and vaccination requirements for teachers and school staff. The second hearing focused on masking and vaccination requirements in healthcare settings. The hearings come shortly after the OHA recently proposed a permanent mask mandate for indoor public spaces. The permanent mandate would mean there is no expiration date on the mask rule, but health officials say they would terminate it once they feel it's no longer necessary. The current mask mandate for Oregon expires on February 8th. OHA has previously said that two of the most important tools the state has to control COVID-19 are vaccination and masking. The meetings come as schools in the Portland metro region continue to struggle with staffing absences due to the COVID pandemic. Six schools in the Portland area returned to in-person learning on Monday. Student and staff absences have played a key role in closing schools in the region. Over the last week, absence rates for students and staff have been high, but seem to be decreasing. It's income tax filing season again, and free help is available to many taxpayers in Oregon. Like last year, tax preparation will look different than it has in the past because of the pandemic. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
Oregonians can get free help with their income taxes once again this year. However, as in recent years, the pandemic is changing what that assistance looks like. Typically, the AARP Foundation's tax aid program happens in person, focusing specifically on people over age 50 or those who have low to moderate incomes. Kathy Gettle is assistant state coordinator of the program for the Portland metro area. She says the recent surge in COVID-19 cases means protocols are in place to protect clients and volunteers.
We have options for virtual preparation. We have options for people dropping off their materials, and then other options for us to scan in their materials and then prepare things remotely and get them back electronically.
Tax aid services usually ramp up around February 1st. Gettle says the goal is to have 75 sites up and running across the state. A site locator will be available along with other tools on the AARP website, as well as on the Internal Revenue Service website. Gettle says she hears often from people who are grateful for help with their taxes.
Some of the credits that are available to seniors and working families are pretty complex, and so we're able to help some with difficult situations that would be hard to get right without training and get them the best possible refunds that they can get.
Gettle is asking people to be patient this year, noting returns will take a bit longer to complete because the appointments aren't happening in person. She says there also are fewer volunteers than usual due to the pandemic. In 2021, about 500 tax aid volunteers in Oregon completed 12,000 tax returns. I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
Portland city leaders and law enforcement officials held a community forum Sunday night to hear concerns about the new police body camera program. The Portland City Council is set to vote this month on the tentative agreement between the Portland Police Bureau and the U.S. Department of Justice. The agreement is linked to excessive force investigations dating back to 2014. Officials took questions from the community on the program, which would require Portland Police Bureau officers to wear body cameras with the footage stored on external servers. Body cameras are just one piece of the puzzle to put the city back in compliance with federal law. The latest agreement would also mean both high-ranking and street-level officers could be investigated for improper use of force. On Sunday, Portland Police Union representatives expressed support for the plan. Portland Police Association President Aaron Schmont said, quote, "Body cameras raise public trust and also provide the public an opportunity to see what's truly going on the street." Despite skepticism about how the footage and investigation will be handled, a majority of the Portland City Council has signaled they will vote to move the program forward. A new report from the American Bar Association found that Oregon has just one-third of the public defenders necessary to address the state's current caseload. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
Oregon has less than one-third the public defenders needed to manage current caseloads. That information comes out of a report released Friday by the American Bar Association. Public defenders represent people who cannot afford their own lawyer. The Sixth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution requires criminal defendants have available and adequate legal representation. Oregon's Office of Public Defense Services requires 1,888 public defenders, but essentially has 592, a 69% shortage. A report 2 years ago from the Sixth Amendment Center already found Oregon's public defense system was unconstitutional. Recently, criminal defendants in several counties have been in custody with no lawyer because of PD shortages. Overloaded systems predictably have bad outcomes. Shortages of public defenders, for example, can lead to wrongful convictions because of inadequate time to investigate the defendant's case. Senator Floyd Prezansky, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, said, quote, "We are primed for having a lawsuit filed against the state for not adequately providing legal services for those who have the right to them. You could see verdicts overturned because of inadequate defense," end quote. Nationwide, many other public defender's offices are also under-resourced. New national caseload standards should be set and announced later this year. The ABA report also stated Oregon's attempts to meet its obligations are not transparent. Oregon contracts the public defense system out to nonprofits and private lawyers. It has no unified case management system and other data collection mechanism. The public defender system plans to go to the legislature next month with funding requests aimed at increasing public defenders' pay. The state will also request technology upgrades to better track contracts. Bobbin Singh, executive director of the Oregon Justice Resource Center, said a strong public defender system prevents violations. He stated, quote, "Public defense is a racial justice issue. It's an equity issue," end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
The federal trial of three former Minneapolis police officers who helped Derek Chauvin restrain George Floyd in May of 2020 began with opening statements on Monday. The three former officers, J. Alexander Kang, Thomas Lane, and To Tao, are charged with deprivation of rights under color of law for failing to render medical aid to Floyd. Tao and Kang are also charged with failing to intervene in Chauvin's use of unreasonable force as he knelt on Floyd's neck and back for 10 minutes. A federal prosecutor said the three colleagues ignored Floyd's pleas for help as Floyd said, quote, "I can't breathe." Samantha Trepel is the special litigation counsel from the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division. Trepel said, quote, "Each made a conscious choice over and over again. They chose not to intervene and stop Chauvin as he killed the man. They chose not to protect George Floyd, the man they handcuffed." Each of the men has pled not guilty to the federal charges. Chauvin admitted guilt in December as part of a plea deal. The trial comes about 20 months after Floyd, a 46-year-old black man, was handcuffed and pressed to the pavement by the officers. The officers called for medical services but did not render aid to Floyd, who fell unconscious and stopped breathing. Bystander video of Floyd's final moments sparked widespread protest in a societal movement against police brutality and racial injustice. The federal case is separate from the state charges for Floyd's death. Chauvin was convicted last year on state charges of murder and manslaughter. Kang, Lane, and Tao have pled not guilty to state charges of aiding and abetting in a trial tentatively scheduled for June of this year. Good government groups are sounding the alarm that American democracy is in peril after a series of setbacks over the past year. Suzanne Potter has more on the story.
Good government groups in Nevada are speaking out, criticizing recent events as a serious threat to democracy. On Friday, news leaked that in December 2020, the Trump White House considered but did not sign an executive order to have the National Guard seize voting machines. On Wednesday, Senate Republicans shut down debate on the Freedom to Vote John R. Lewis Act. Las Vegas attorney Bradley Schrager, an expert on campaign law, says this is no time to be complacent.
It's going to get much, much worse before it gets better. But all we can do is work as hard as we can. It's always darkest right before the dawn, but let's get through the darkness because it's here.
Also last week, Governor Steve Sisolak called for action against members of the Republican Party who filed false electoral documents, submitting a fake set of electors for former President Trump to Congress and the National Archives in Nevada and in six other states that he lost. Emily Persaud Zamora with Silver State Voices says the issue of voting rights is foundational.
No progress could be accomplished if we're not prioritizing democracy. And I think that this conversation is finally getting people to see that.
The Freedom to Vote Act would have given people in all 50 states some of the policies that Nevadans already enjoy. Same-day voter registration, no-excuse mail-in balloting, extended early voting, and automatic restoration of voting rights to many formerly incarcerated individuals. This is Suzanne Potter reporting.
The U.S. State Department issued an advisory on Monday authorizing non-emergency diplomatic employees to depart Ukraine along with their family members. This comes amid Russia's continued military presence along the country's border. The State Department also warned Americans not to travel to Ukraine or Russia, citing the possibility of Russian military action. Moscow has amassed more than 100,000 troops at its border with Ukraine, but has denied planning an invasion even as global fears mount. President Joe Biden has said military action, including an invasion, could be imminent. In his news conference last week, marking 1 year in office, Biden warned, quote, if they actually do what they're capable of doing with the forces amassed on the border, it's going to be a disaster for Russia. Our allies and partners are ready to impose severe costs and significant harm on Russia and the Russian economy, end quote. Ukraine's embassy said Saturday that the first shipment of lethal aid from the U.S., including ammunition intended for Ukraine's frontline defenders, had touched down in Kiev. A senior State Department official said the advisory should not be taken as a sign that the U.S. believes an invasion will definitely happen in the coming hours or days, and added that the advisory is not intended to affect U.S. support for Ukraine. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the COVID outbreak at the Multnomah County Inverness Jail. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Tonight's weather will be foggy with a low of 36 degrees. Tomorrow will again be foggy, giving way to clearer skies in the afternoon. The National Weather Service has issued an air stagnation advisory for the Portland metro area until Wednesday afternoon. Air stagnation could result in poor air quality, and state agencies recommend pausing outdoor burning. Today in history, in 1965, Sir Winston Churchill, the British leader who guided Great Britain and the Allies through the crisis of World War II, dies in London at age 90. The quote of the day is from British statesman Sir Winston Churchill, who served as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom from 1940 to 1945, and again from 1951 to 1955. Churchill said, quote, success consists of going from failure to failure without loss of enthusiasm. D.C. becomes ground zero for the fights over vaccine mandates and the right to abortion. Dr. Anthony Fauci says we'll have to learn to live with COVID-19, and investigators say Donald Trump considered seizing voting machines. With more on those stories, it's 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
If you give government the license to silence its critics, you have given them the capacity to commit any atrocity they want.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the son of the slain U.S. Senator, spoke at a Defeat the Mandates rally in Washington, D.C., where thousands of opponents of COVID vaccine mandates gathered. The protesters included people who were pro-vaccine but anti-mandate, and some opposed to both. The event was held in a city that recently mandated an indoor vaccine requirement for those 12 and older. D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser.
We have to be sure to get tested when we need to be tested to get vaccinated. And those are the ways back to a more normal life.
White House Chief Medical Advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci predicts the surge of cases caused by the Omicron variant will peak by mid-February. On Sunday, Fauci said the best case scenario will be to bring the virus under control with vaccines and tests and learn to live with it. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the U.S. and its allies are preparing to counter Russia if it invades Ukraine. UK intelligence suggests Moscow wants to replace that nation's government with a pro-Russia leader. The Kremlin denies the charge, but Britain is shipping weapons to Ukraine. The House January 6th committee is investigating whether the Trump administration planned to have the military seize voting machines after the 2020 election. Chair Benny Thompson said the panel already discussed the matter with former Attorney General Bill Barr. Events across the country marked Friday's 49th anniversary of the Supreme Court's landmark Roe v. Wade abortion rights decision. Legal observers say the conservative majority now in the court looks likely to uphold a Mississippi law banning abortions at 15 weeks. That's the home state of Republican Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith, who says it's the most significant opportunity to overturn Roe v. Wade in half a century.
Today, we march with greater hope and prayer for the Supreme Court to show grace to the unborn in the Dobbs case.
Counter rallies were also held.
Abortion, no!
If Roe is overturned, pro-choice groups expect abortion will become illegal in about two dozen states. However, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker pledged to make his state a refuge for reproductive rights.
Let's be loud and clear. Abortion restrictions endanger women. They force patients to travel tens, hundreds, thousands of miles, empty their savings accounts, or worst of all, turn to options that put their lives at risk.
Senator Kyrsten Sinema was censured Saturday by the Arizona Democratic Party. That vote came after Sinema joined fellow centrist Joe Manchin of West Virginia in blocking efforts to change the filibuster to pass voting rights legislation. After reaching record highs late last year, stock markets are down sharply this month. The declines came after the Federal Reserve said it would no longer be buying bonds under its quantitative easing program. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our A-Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Hopi tribe responds to a surge in COVID cases. A demonstration is held at a football playoff game in Kansas City, and the USDA will hold a tribal consultation on the meat industry. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Hopi tribe in northern Arizona has returned to heightened public health restrictions on the reservation amid a surge in COVID-19 cases. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, as in nearly all parts of the U.S., it's being driven by the highly transmittable Omicron variant.
The order comes amid a dramatic uptick in COVID infections on the Hopi Reservation. According to the tribe, there were nearly 300 confirmed active positive cases recently. During last year's winter spike, by comparison, the tribe was averaging between 5 and 25 new known infections per week. Hopi Chairman Timothy Nuvongyama and Vice Chairman Craig Andrews signed the order that returns the tribe to its earlier Phase 2 restrictions. Hopi leaders lifted the mandates last spring as active cases declined to near zero. The new current order requires masks to be worn in all public facilities and buildings, common areas, and outdoor locations. It also discourages tourism and visitation and directs tribal police officers and health professionals to perform welfare checks on some tribal members. In addition, the order recommends that Hopi businesses restrict capacity to half and implement screening for staff along with cleaning and disinfecting protocols. It'll remain in place until March 13th. More than 90% of eligible Hopi tribal members have been fully vaccinated against COVID. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heiches in Flagstaff.
Native American community members in the greater Kansas City area are continuing to call on the Kansas City football team to change their name and end the use of Indian stereotypes. Members of the group, Not In Our Honor, demonstrated at the team's home playoff game on Sunday. Gaylene Krauser is director of the Kansas City Indian Center.
Our purpose out here is to continue to raise awareness about the stereotypical use of our imagery and the blatant racism that still occurs, you know, all these years after the fight for civil rights. And so Indigenous people are still way at the bottom of that list, being recognized for who we are as human beings.
Members of the group and their allies hosted demonstrations outside the team stadium at all home games during the NFL 2021 season. They also have 4 Change the Name billboards up in the city.
The team is woven into everything in Kansas City. All this messaging out there that it's okay with us as Indian people, and it's not. And if nobody else stands up and says, hey, this isn't cool, then their message just stands unanswered. And so we have to, as Indian organizations here in Kansas City, we have to be the ones that stand out here in the cold and say, hey, that is not the truth. They do have a couple of people that have said it's okay and on their working group, but the majority of us don't agree with it.
The group has long called for the Kansas City football team to end the use of Native imagery, including in the Arrowhead logo, and the use of Native terms, and seek the NFL's zero tolerance for on-field use of racial slurs to be applied. Fans are banned from wearing warlike paint or headdresses into the stadium. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is holding a tribal leader consultation and listening session Thursday on creating a plan to create a more competitive, fairer market for meat, poultry, and seafood processing. The USDA is seeking input from tribes as there are new funding opportunities being made available. The White House announced a nationwide plan earlier this month to boost competition and reduce prices in the meat processing industry. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Many Americans are relocating to climate-vulnerable areas. They're moving to regions at higher risk from wildfires, heavy downpours, and floods. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Dangerous wildfires, heavy downpours, damaging floods. As the climate warms, many parts of the U.S. are in growing danger from extreme events. It would make sense for people to start moving out of the most vulnerable areas, but a report from the real estate company Redfin shows that the opposite is happening. From 2016 through 2020, more people moved to high-risk areas than low-risk areas.
People were actually leaving some of the places with a lower climate risk. These tend to be places in the Midwest, the Rust Belt, that have had less economic prosperity, and they're tending to move to areas in the Sun Belt, so Florida, Texas, Arizona, Nevada.
Daryl Fairweather is Redfin's chief economist. She says people are often lured by warmer winters or new economic opportunities. Others are leaving areas such as San Francisco that lack affordable housing.
And what happens is that people get pushed further and further away from the city center into Central California that has high fire risk.
So from people searching for affordability to those seeking warmer winters, a growing number of people are in the path of increasingly extreme weather. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
A recent forecast shows good ocean conditions for the Pacific Northwest salmon, but advocates for the endangered fish say that shouldn't obscure the perilous state the species is currently in. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Recent data on ocean conditions could be good news for struggling salmon in the Northwest, but advocates for the species warn this isn't enough to stop their alarming slide. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is expecting ocean waters to remain cold and more food abundant for the fish along the west coast. However, Miles Johnson with Columbia Riverkeeper notes this doesn't necessarily mean better conditions for a crucial part of their lives, in the rivers where salmon spawn.
It's good to be in a good cycle, but what this is an opportunity to fix the problems that we have in the freshwater and jumpstart some kind of recovery. It's not going to get us out of the hole that we're in.
Climate change is another factor. A recent study from Columbia University's Earth Institute shows land temperatures are increasing 2.5 times faster than ocean temperatures, meaning wildlife in land and river systems are more vulnerable to the warming climate. Johnson says the biggest impediments for endangered salmon species are the 4 dams on the Lower Snake River. He says the dams turn the river into dangerously hot lakes for the migrating fish, and the quickest and most effective way to remedy this is by breaching them.
This is not anything that we've arrived at quickly or rashly. This is the conclusion that most of the scientific community has come to after trying basically everything else. It's just clear that Snake River fish aren't going to recover with those 4 dams in place.
Opponents of dam removal say they provide irrigation, renewable energy, and transportation to the region. Johnson says the ocean will go through cycles of good and bad years for salmon, and that we should act to save them from extinction while conditions are favorable.
And they will recover if we give them half a chance. We've seen it over and over again in different contexts.
I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 24th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Emma Lugo. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Jonah Chester, Antonia Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website, kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, it's Alternative Radio, featuring lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Times Like Now with host Trevor Collins. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus. Host Joseph Gallivan interviews artist KHEM about his show Smiles of Planet Earth, on now in Northwest Portland. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We're looking at the COVID outbreak at the Multnomah County Inverness Jail. Stay with us.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Spread of the Omicron variant of coronavirus has reached Multnomah County's Inverness Jail, and the outbreak is severe. KBOO reporter and Prison Pipeline host Emma Lugo spoke with two legal assistants at the Public Defender's Office, Carlene and Rowan, to learn more.
Where is Inverness Jail?
Inverness Jail is one of the two county jails in Multnomah County. It's located in the Park Rose neighborhood, and it's an open dorm style setting, which means that all of the people in custody are sleeping in bunks